Welcome to Tashma, the podcast where you get to listen in on Hadar's Beit Midrash. I'm Rabbi Eli Confer, filling in for Rabbi Avi Killip. During the high holiday season, we focus on repairing what we've broken. In her drasha, Can We Reverse the Irreversible? Tshuva for a Broken World, Dina Weiss considers a different understanding of the function of tshuva, challenging us to articulate the value of trying to undo what is, in fact, irreversible, and learn how to live with what will be forever broken. Let's listen in.
We want, right, Yom Kippur to also be, right, this moment that allows us to definitely, right, come back to the way things were with other people. And what we are going to talk about tonight is really questioning ourselves from trying to make Yom Kippur do work that Yom Kippur cannot do. So we are going to start with the Mishnah in Yomi. Averot shebein adam lemakom, when we have infractions between a person and God, between the person and the omnipresent, for that Yom Kippur atones. But for infractions between one person and another, Yom Kippur does not atone until he appeases his friend. And the way that this is often understood is, well, Yom Kippur is still the deadline for appeasing your friend, right? But you have to appease your friend by Yom Kippur, and then God will forgive you. But I think that's actually not the right way to read this until or unless in this Mishnah. I think what this Mishnah is actually saying is Yom Kippur is the day for infractions between people and God. When you're talking about infractions between a person and their fellow, actually, there is an entirely different system, an entirely different timeline. So I think that it's going to be helpful for us to kind of separate the terminology. When we're talking about our relationship with God, right, the language that we want to use is we're getting atonement. There's some kind of punishment or some kind of bad blood, as it were, between us and God. Kapara kind of wipes that away. And the process for getting kapara is tshuva, is this process of repentance, of trying to get back to the way that things were. But when we're talking about person and their fellow, okay, the language is ritzoi. It's appeasement in order to get forgiveness. Okay, the language of michilah, forgiveness, is actually, when we use it from God, it's actually borrowed, right, from human terms. And that is when I am owed something by you, when I give it up, that's michilah. When I forgive a debt, that is forgiveness, okay? And so I want you to really see this proof text that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, because this is actually where I'm basing myself. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, look at how great Yom Kippur is. You are going to be purified from all of your sins before God. Mikol chatotechem lifnei Adonai titar. Okay? And what is he using this verse to say? Yom Kippur atones for infractions between a person and the omnipresent, meaning only sins that are between us and God does Yom Kippur atone. Okay, it's actually not relevant to the question of what about my relationship with other people? What about what I owe other people? What about the forgiveness that I am trying to get from another person? Okay, if Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's proof text had been about two people forgiving one another, then we would say Yom Kippur is also the deadline for my relationship with my friend. But it's very clear that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah wants you to understand that Yom Kippur is about lifnei Hashem. It's about things that are happening between you and God, and it is not about what is happening between you and your friend. And the reason why this is important, and I hope that you're already thinking in this direction, if each of you have ever been in a situation where you have been apologized to, and you get the sense that person was apologizing to you because they felt Yom Kippur was coming, right? You can only, you have a little bit of a sense of, isn't really apologizing to me, because they have a kind of internal sense of the apology that I'm owed. They have some sort of internal sense that they want to reconcile with me. And actually, what they want to do is they want to get clean with God, and my not forgiving them is an obstacle in their relationship with God. And so they're asking me for forgiveness, but they're not really asking me as a person, me as someone they want to be in relationship with, for forgiveness. Actually, they're asking me for forgiveness because I'm an obstacle to their having some kind of reconciliation, some kind of atonement from God. Okay, and this is something that I think is really important. We're going to see a number of stories in the Gemara on this mission that I think makes it clear, you know, in the way that stories can make things clear if you read them in a very specific way, that the notion of having a Yom Kippur deadline and of treating our relationships with other people, the way that we treat our relationship with God, actually does much more harm than good. Okay, so we're going to go into source number 2, which is the Gemara in Yoma. Rabbi Yitzchak says, anyone who antagonized his friend, kol ha-maknit et chavero. And for those of you who are grammar nerds, right, the language of maknit is actually very unusual. And it literally means to take a piece out of. Okay, so it's a very, I think, evocative term for when you really hurt someone, you take a piece out of them. And when you're apologizing, what you're trying to do is give them that piece back, right? To make them whole, not really to make you whole. Okay. So he says, anyone who antagonizes his friend, even just verbally, needs to make it up to him. Okay, it's very easy for me to make it up to you if what I've done is stolen something material. You were out $5, I give you back the $5, now you're whole. Okay, but what about when I do something to you on a verbal level, right? When I hurt your feelings, how am I going to make it up to you? Okay, and so we have this somewhat unusually long passage from Proverbs, from Mishle, talking about being a guarantor. Okay, so we're using the verse that's talking about financial complications, right? Complicated financial relationships, to then translate into how would that be for my verbal, right? Regular interpersonal feelings, right? I think the verbal is a stand-in for feelings type of relationship with someone else. So it says, my son, right? In Mishle, we're always addressing my child, my student. If you served as a guarantor for your fellow, you shook hands with a stranger, takata lezar, and you got caught by the words of your mouth. Okay, so the situation is you made a promise, but now you must get stuck into the mouth. Okay. However, do this and be saved. So the verse in Mishle is now being read as, if you have been caught by the words of your mouth, if you said something you should not have said, here is how you're going to be saved. When you come to the hand of your fellow, humble yourself and appease your fellow. If his money is in your hand, release and give him from the palm of your hand. And if not, you should bring many friends to him. Harbe alav re'im. It's a little bit of a play on words with rahams. To harbe, re'im means friends. It actually means friends in both contexts. There's this weird strategy of, if you owe somebody money, you pay them back with money. If you owe somebody on an emotional level, you pay them back with friends. You bring many friends, okay? And Rav Chista said, you need to appease him with 3 rows of 3 people, right? And actually has to be a kind of elaborate display of friends. The Gemara doesn't really explain what it means here, but I think that what is going on is we are talking about a kind of honor society, right? And the most common way that a person will be damaged by words would be that their reputation would be damaged. And how do I make it to you that I sort of humbled you? I'm going to humble myself, and I'm going to acknowledge in the presence of this phalanx, really, of friends, that I have done you wrong. I'm going to acknowledge, right, in front of other people that I have done the wrong thing. Okay, it's really important here, right, that the kind of backup that this person is bringing is not an oath before God, it is an oath before other people. If what I've done to you is interpersonal, the solution has to be interpersonal. Just as if I had done something wrong to you financially, the solution has to be financial, right? So I think that even if the actual, you know, strategy of bringing a lot of friends is not culturally resonant for us right now, this is not the way that I would like to be apologized to. But I think that what's being stated here very clearly is, if you have an interpersonal problem, it's an interpersonal solution. It's not before God, and it is not financial. You cannot pay your way out. And Rabbi Yossi Bar Hanina said, we're continuing on, anyone who requests forgiveness from their friend should not ask them more than three times. As it says, Ana sana viata sana, please, please bear, and now please bear. Okay, these are actually three different phrases from the story of Yosef and his brothers. And it seems that there is a three-time limit. Okay, why is there a three-time limit of my asking you for forgiveness? Right, I think that there's a sense here of respecting that you don't need to forgive me. I am going to put in the effort that I feel that I need to do in order to reconcile with you. But I understand that forgiveness is an ode to me. And after I've asked you three times, I'm going to step aside and I'm going to say, when you're ready, you're going to come to me. And another, you know, something that's going on in the background here, right, is that there's nothing happening in either of these statements that have anything to do with Yom Kippur. Okay, when I owe you money, when I hurt your feelings, it's not, the deadline is not Yom Kippur. Okay, it actually seems that the deadline is, if you continue to, and if he dies, he should bring 10 people and have them stand on his grave and say, I have sinned before God, the God of Israel, and this person that I damaged. Seems pretty clear that the deadline is death, right? That you have to sort of constantly be attuned, listening for those opportunities for when your friend might be receptive for your apology. But the timeline is entirely unique to that person and your relationship with that person. It has nothing to do with Yom Kippur. The next story that we're going to see is kind of like a little bit of a slapstick, where I'm going to just kind of summarize it outside because the language is a little bit confusing. Basically, Rabbi Abba was mad at Rabbi Yirmiah. It seems like with good reason. Rabbi Yirmiah feels bad. He wants to apologize. So he decides to just kind of on Rabbi Abba's doorstep. Okay, Rabbi Yirmiah has to apologize to Rabbi Abba, so he goes to Rabbi Abba's house and he sits on the doorstep. He's sitting there, and while he's sitting there, Rabbi Abba's maid pours a chamber pot contents on his head. Okay, and so he says about himself, "May Ashpot Yarim Evyon. I'm so happy that I got poured, you know, urine and feces on me. Because now I'm like a dung heap," because that's where they used to go to the bathroom. They used to go to the bathroom in sort of a landfill. And now I can only go up unless somebody has dumped their poop on me. It's only going uphill from here. So Rabbi Yirmiah is thrilled, right, that he has been debased in this way by Rabbi Abba's maid, because he thinks that that is going to be the first step for his way. Okay, but Rabbi Abba's approach, when he comes and he hears about this, Rabbi Abba heard and went out to greet him, and he said to him, "Great, now I have to appease you." Right, as it says, and this is from the pasuk that we saw in Mishlei, if your friend has been humbled, now you have to go and appease him. Okay, and I think that what Rabbi Abba is saying is, Rabbi Yirmiah, now I've hurt you, and now we're in a kind of cycle of violence. You have kind of debased yourself too much. Now I owe you. And what you've done, this is like a real psychological insight here. When you apologize too much, when you go over the three apology limit, when you have, you know, someone actually debasing you and pouring urine on your head, then, right, you're making that person feel bad. You're guilting that person into forgiving you. And you're changing the dynamic of who is the victim and who is the perpetrator. You're kind of forcing the person who you hurt to then hurt you and then think of themselves as the perpetrator and then force them to apologize to you. right? And Rabbi Yirmiyah is thrilled, right? Because he's getting the kind of evening of the score that he wants. But Rabbi Abba's not happy. Because Rabbi Abba doesn't want to be in a position where now he has to go and he has to ask Rabbi Yirmiyah for forgiveness, right? There's something about the kind of artificialness here that Rabbi Abba didn't go to Rabbi Yirmiyah. Rabbi Yirmiyah went to Rabbi Abba, and we know that he wasn't welcome because he didn't knock on the door and come in. He had to sit outside the stoop. It's very clear that Rabbi Yirmiyah did not understand that he wasn't supposed to impose in that way. And Rabbi Abba said, you think this worked out for you? Right, it worked out for you, but it didn't work out for me. And now I'm in a bad position. I'm in a relationship with you that I don't want to be in. And we can see the opposite of the dynamic between Rabbi Abba and Rabbi Yirmiyah. We continue on in the story with Rabbi Zeira. Whenever Rabbi Zeira had an issue with someone, he would repeatedly pass before them and make himself present to them so that they could come out and appease him. Okay, so Rabbi Zeira is modeling the moment that you know that you should be reconciling with this person that you hurt. They need to take some step in your direction, okay? If you know that that person is receptive to your apology, that is the time to apologize. Not when Yom Kippur is coming, not when you feel like you can't take it anymore. It is a kind of victim-centered approach. When you're aware that the victim is really open and receptive to your apology, then and only then are you supposed to try and be in relationship with them. And I think that the relationship to Yom Kippur, right up to this moment, Yom Kippur has not been mentioned. And now we're going to have two stories where it seems clear that Yom Kippur is either a neutral or probably an aggravating factor to people not getting forgiveness. So Rav had an issue with a certain butcher who did not come to reconcile with him on Erev Yom Kippur. Okay, Rav was offended by this butcher, and he's expecting the butcher to come and apologize to him. Okay, he thinks Yom Kippur is the deadline. For sure, the butcher is going to feel bad, and the butcher is going to come and apologize to him. When the butcher never showed up, Rav said, "Okay, I'll call Rabbi Zeira, and I'm going to go and make up with him. So I'm going to go over to the butcher shop on Erev Yom Kippur." And Rav Huna met him on his way and said to him, "Where are you headed?" And Rav said, "Oh, I'm going to appease so-and-so." Right? Apparently, it's well known that they have this feud. And Rav says, "Yeah, I just want to make myself present and see if we can work it out." And Rav Huna said, "Abba," that is Rav, that's his first name, "is going to kill someone. This is not going to end well." But anyway, Rav went and stood upon the butcher who was sitting and skinning a head. He raised his eyes and he said to him, "Hey, are you Abba?" Right, which is, of course, extremely disrespectful, right? This is a butcher speaking to like the most significant rabbi, you know, in the time period and referring to him by his first name. And he says, "Good, I don't have an issue with you. I don't want to talk to you. I am not in a position to reconcile with you." And as he was skinning the head, a bone slipped, hit the butcher in his own skull, and killed him. Okay? And so what we see here, right, is again this dynamic of the victim and the perpetrator, right? That the butcher, because he didn't go and apologize, and Rav came to him, then he becomes even more guilty. And because Rav is trying to reconcile before the time is right, it ends up being very violent, right? It ends up really coming to, literally, right, coming on the head of the butcher. And you could see what's going on. There's the pressure. Rav has no indication from the butcher that the butcher wants to reconcile. Rav is motivated by his own feeling of Yom Kippur is coming. I got to clean this up. And the butcher says, "No, right? That timeline isn't working for me. I'm not ready to apologize. I'm not in that space." Right, and this forcing of it, it ends up having this really tragic end. For the sake of time, I'm not going to read the next story, but it's essentially a story where a teacher kind of loses their patience because a student is late, which is something that I can very much identify with. But he goes a little bit too far, and then he ends up being in a position where he needs to apologize. And he apologizes 13 Erev Yom Kippurs in a row. 13. Okay, and one way to read this is, wow, he was so mad that for 13 years he held on to the grudge. But I think another way of reading this is he was only apologized to on Erev Yom Kippur. The only time, right, that Rav came to apologize to Rabbi Hanina, who is a student in this story, is when Erev Yom Kippur came. And so Rabbi Hanina was never in a position to feel like this apology was genuine, because it was always on this timeline. Okay, so we have two stories of the way in which having Yom Kippur be the impetus, instead of having this sort of natural relationship, just that person's own timeline being the determinant, ends up having really tragic consequences. I want to go back to this idea that we mentioned earlier about not apologizing after three times, right? You really put in your effort, you're very sincere, you apologize three times, and then you're supposed to stop. Okay. Now my reading of that is, and I hope that it's been somewhat persuasive for those of you who are, you know, listening at home, that it's kind of like disrespectful. After the third time, stop nudging, stop pressing. You've done your part. That person knows that you want to reconcile with them. When they meet you, they're going to come and meet you. But we also see this dynamic when we're talking about tshuva with God, that there's a whole conversation about once you've already apologized, once you've already done vidoy, once you've already confessed a sin, you're not supposed to keep on confessing it, right? Either God is going to hear you and forgive you, or not, right? But you can't keep on pushing. You can't keep on nudging. But the Rambam, and we're going to scroll down to source 3, actually says that the reason why after the third moment you're supposed to stop apologizing is that then it becomes the responsibility of the person who was aggrieved to forgive you. But they actually have an obligation to forgive you. And I generally don't do this. I generally don't quote sources only to disagree with me. But I'm making an exception with this Rambam, because I think that this Rambam has really become the kind of dominant way to think about sort of obligations of forgiveness. And I think that it actually becomes quite harmful. As we saw in the stories, when Rabbi Yirmiya ends up being sort of degraded by Rabbi Abba, then Rabbi Abba, who used to be the victim, now is being forced to be the perpetrator. And that's actually not fair. But the Rambam thinks that is fair. Okay, so we're going to see what he says. If his friend didn't want to forgive him, what if I apologized? And my friend didn't accept my apology. So Dina would say, you got to live with it. That's what you're called to do. But the Rambam says he should bring a row of three of his friends, and they pressure him and ask forgiveness from him. Okay, the rows of friends we saw in the Gemara. The language in the Gemara was lifayes, to appease. The language in the Rambam is upoginbo, and they pressure him. Okay, so you already see that the Rambam has a different idea of what these friends are supposed to do. I thought that these friends are there to show, I'm, you know, humbling myself before you. I'm acknowledging in front of all of these people that I've done the wrong thing and that you're the person who's in the right. The Rambam basically reads these groups of friends as like supporting me, the apologizer, and putting pressure on the aggrieved to forgive me. If he isn't appeased by them, he brings a second and a third, right? I'm going to get two rows of friends and then three rows of friends until I have my proper phalanx of 9 friends. If he doesn't want to reconcile, he leaves him and goes on his way, right? The apologizer says, 3 times is enough, I'm going to go. And the one who didn't forgive is the one who has sinned. Because it is forbidden for a person to be cruel, and not be appeased. Rather, he should be easy to appease and difficult to anger. which some of you might recognize from the Yisrichot liturgy. And when the sinner asks him to forgive, he should forgive with a complete heart and a willing soul. Even if he hurt him a lot and sinned greatly against him, he should not take revenge and he shouldn't bear a grudge. Okay, so the Rambam says, it's actually not your right to remain angry. Once somebody has apologized to you, you must forgive them. And if you don't, you are the sinner, right? And the Rambam supports this in two ways. The first is that he says, if you don't, it's cruel. Achsari, you're going to be cruel. And the second is that he says, you're not allowed to bear a grudge, right? It says in Sefer Vayikra that you're not allowed to bear a grudge. And now this person is bearing a grudge. Right, so obviously the Rambam knows what he's talking about. And the Rambam is, I think, uncomfortable with saying, it's nobody's fault, this can't be resolved, you should apologize, and you did. You should forgive, but sometimes you can't. And we're actually just going to leave it like this. The Rambam is deeply uncomfortable with that. And so he says, actually, it's going to be either the responsibility of the sinner or it's the responsibility of the aggrieved. And if they don't forgive, then they're the sinner. But there always needs to be someone who is to blame, right? And I would like to argue that sometimes there isn't, right? Sometimes people are just not ready to forgive, and we don't necessarily have to assign blame to the aggrieved party. I don't want the aggrieved party to then be considered the perpetrator. Sometimes people are just not ready. Sometimes the time is not right. And the Rambam gets this language of Achsari. He doesn't invent it. He gets it from the Mishnah in Bava Kamma. For those of you who are familiar with Talmud, the fact that we're going to Bava Kamma is going to be very interesting to you. And for those of you who are not, I'm going to take you along with us. But up until now, we have been in Masechet Yoma. We've been in the tractate that deals with Yom Kippur. Of course, we're going to be talking about forgiveness and the tractate that talks about Yom Kippur, right? But actually, once we realize that interpersonal forgiveness is in a totally different world than divine forgiveness, because interpersonal forgiveness is actually about me paying you back, you accepting and forgiving, we realize that actually the right place for this conversation is Bava Kamma, which deals with the laws of damages. Where are the laws for when my ox gores your ox and I have to pay you back? Bava Kamma. Okay, so we are going into that world because that's actually the world that we're in. This conversation about me forgiving my friend for something they've done to me does not really belong to Masechet Yoma. The only reason why we have this conversation there in the first place is for the point of contrast, right? That God is going to forgive you when you do tshuva, but your friend is not necessarily going to forgive you when you try to appease them. You need to be working with them and be working on their time. Okay, so Avo Pishuhuno Telo, right? Even though I sort of give you what you're owed, he is not forgiven until he asks forgiveness from him. So we're in Surah number 4 in the first box, as it says, and now return the wife of this man, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you. The context here is when Avimelech captures Sarah, and then God tells Avimelech, you know, you need to give Sarah back. She's actually not available. And he says, give her back. And also, ask this man, that is Abraham, to pray for you. And the language of prayer, and the language of appeasement, pei lamed lamed, were actually almost identical in some of the halachic sources. So the text understands that Abraham praying for Avimelech is his saying, I forgive you. Okay, so God tells Avimelech, you can't just give back the wife and walk away. You need to give back the wife, acknowledge what you did, and apologize and ask for forgiveness. And then it continues, and from where do we know that the mochel should not be achzari, that the forgiver should not be cruel? As it says, Avraham indeed prayed to God. Okay, so this is where the Rambam got the notion, if someone doesn't forgive, they are considered to be cruel. We get it from this passage. Okay, but what's really important to notice is you're not forgiven until you ask for forgiveness. Returning is not enough. And then how do we know that you shouldn't be cruel? It doesn't say that you must forgive. It says you shouldn't be cruel. The Rambam turns that into a must. But the language here is actually not yet a must. And in fact, when we continue in the Gemara in the Yerushalmi, the Gemara starts to use sort of flowery language. And whenever the Talmud or the halachic literature uses overly flowery language, it's to compensate for something. What is it compensate for? That I don't have a law, right? If I know what you must do, I tell you, this is what you must do. If this is what you really should do, but I can't force you to do it, then I say, yeah, but you'll have all these great things happen to you if you do it, and it would be so nice, and here are some verses. Okay, so when we see that the Gemara is going to continue and use the homiletic language to tell you that you should forgive, that's how we know that you don't actually have to forgive. You should. And if you don't, it's cruel. But it's not actually required. It is taught that Rabbi Yehuda said in the name of Rabban Gamliel, or the second box in source number 4, behold, it says, don't let anything be in your hand from the spoils, so that God will rescind his fury and will give you mercy and have mercy on you. Okay, this is a passage that's like not really talking about, you know, anything that necessarily has to do with tshuva or forgiveness. There's this kind of parallelism of God will give you mercy and have mercy on you. There's this double language, right? To give you mercy is, can also be read as to make you merciful. So when you are merciful, then God has mercy on you. And this sign should be in your hand. Siman zayehe biyat. Whenever you see someone who is a merciful person, the omnipresent has mercy on him. But if you aren't merciful, then the omnipresent won't have mercy on you. Okay, so here we see that I'm not responsible, required to grant you forgiveness, but I should, and God will have mercy on me if I have mercy on you. We're going to continue. We're going to see the exact same idea that we saw in the Babylonian Talmud in Masechet Yomah. Now, in the Yerushalmi, in Bava Kamma, right, in the context of this, nothing to do with Yom Kippur, but has to do with reconciling, where the second paragraph, Rav said, a person who has become displeasing to his friend and has asked for forgiveness from him and was not accepted should make a roll of pipa and appease him, as it says, make a line, da 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 da. We already saw this. And Rabbi Yossi said, this, we're after the ellipsis. This is the most important part. We're finally getting to the things that cannot be reversed. Rabbi Yossi said, this is said in a case where he hasn't slandered him. But if he did slander him, hotzi lo shame ra, ein lo mechila olamit. He can never be forgiven. Okay, so we have this whole conversation about you got to give him back what you owe him. You got to apologize. He's got to forgive. If he doesn't forgive, he's not going to get compassion. But there's a line. If what that person has done is ruined your reputation, hotzi lo shame ra, slander. You can't fix that, right? Why can't you fix that? There is the kind of emotional piece, right? That maybe somebody just doesn't recover from it. But also, the Yerushalmi refers to Lashon Hara, when it talks about evil speech, slander, uses a very instructive terminology. It calls it Lishna Tilita, three-part language. What does that mean? When I have a conversation with you, that's two-part language, that's a dialogue. Lashon Hara is a true one, right? Because I am talking about you to someone else. There's always going to be someone else. And then there's always going to be a someone else from the someone else and a someone else from a someone else. I can't change those people's minds. I can't have them unhear what they heard. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the story about the pillow and the feathers that, you know, somebody is slandered, and then they went to the rabbi and they wanted to, you know, make it up to him. And the rabbi says, sure, why don't you take the pillow and scatter all the feathers. And then he comes back and he's like, am I good? And the rabbi said, no, you're going to be good when you go, when you collect all those feathers. And then he says, well, I can't collect all the feathers. And the rabbi says, yeah, I know, right? But once you've already spoken this bad speech, it's out there. You have no way of knowing where it went. You do not control it. And the you know, the language of the feathers, you know, it's kind of like sweet and kind of bumbling. But when the Midrash talks about it, the Midrash uses the language of arrows, right? Once you shoot the arrow, you're not in control of it anymore. It's going to hit its target, whether you want it to or not, right? It's going to have that negative effect. You're not in control of it anymore. You have released the arrow once that negative speech has left your mouth. Why, you know, before Yom Kippur, do I want to talk about things that can never be forgiven? It's a good question. And I will tell you before we get to the end. The reason I want to talk about the things that aren't necessarily going to be reconciled, aren't necessarily going to be forgiven, is because I think we actually need a little bit of a corrective to the way that we think about Yom Kippur. Because even if we don't say so explicitly, we kind of always have in the back of our mind, there's this kind of safety valve of Yom Kippur. And it's extremely beautiful, right? When it comes to our relationship with God, to know, right, that ultimately God has faith in us and God forgives us. But this same belief, which is so beautiful and so healing and so helpful, when it comes to our relationship with God, can actually be really pernicious and really, really, really destructive when it comes to our relationship with other people. Okay, and if we don't fully take into account, right, the seriousness of that, we're not always going to get that forgiveness that we want, right? It really forces us to pause and think, maybe I'm not going to say, right, that thing that I was thinking of saying, right? Maybe I'm going to take that extra pause before I release that arrow, before I open that pillow, and all of the feathers fly away. And we're going to bring this back to Yom Kippur for just a moment, because it isn't only true about human beings, that there are things that you may never get forgiveness for. It's also true about God. There's an exception to the rule of God being super forgiving, and the exception to that rule is Chilul Hashem, profaning God's name. Chilul Hashem, profaning God's name, is essentially the divine equivalent of Lashon Hara between human beings, right? When I say something or do something that demonstrates something negative about God, that doesn't only involve me and God. That involves God's reputation throughout the whole world. And I actually cannot get any kapara for that. I can never be forgiven for that until I die. But someone who is responsible for profaning God's name, Tuva does not have the power to suspend, and Yom Kippur cannot atone, and suffering cannot purge. Rather, everything waits and death purges. As it says, and it will be revealed in the ears of God of hosts if this sin will be atoned for you before you die. But actually, even when it comes to God, there are certain things that we cannot take back. When we have our relationship with God sour someone else's relationship with God, and when we ruin God's reputation through profaning God's name, we can't take back those arrows. We can't take back those feathers. There is a sense in which the model of there being something irreconcilable, unrepeatable, okay, for human beings, God also, actually, for the divine equivalent, God also can't. God can't control those feathers that you released from your pillow, that arrow that came out of your mouth. The Chafetz Chaim literally wrote the book on Lashon Hara. There was no actually sense that there were laws of Lashon Hara in any sort of specific way before he came and he wrote the book. So really, he got to have the first and often final say. But in this particular conversation, he doesn't have the final say. So we're going to read the laws as he presents them, and then we're going to go and see some of the pushback, okay, that the Chafetz Chaim received in his lifetime for his articulation of this view. And even if his friend doesn't know that he said anything about him, right? What if I spoke Lashon Hara about Bob? Bob doesn't know. I told Nancy. It never came back to Bob. He has no idea that I wronged him. Okay, so now we have two possibilities. I could let it slide, not tell Bob what happened, or I could tell Bob, you should know that I actually said this really terrible thing about you to Nancy. Oh, and I'm really, really sorry about it. Okay, those are my two options. And the Chofetz Chaim, you can hear from the sarcasm in my voice, doesn't choose the option that I would choose because he does go with the second option. He says, you got to go and tell Bob, I spoke Lashon Hara about you. I said something negative about you. Can you forgive me? Okay, and if his friend doesn't know that he said anything about him, he still has to reveal to him what he did to him. And that it was not appropriate, and to ask him for forgiveness. And from this, we can see how horrible it is to speak Lashon Hara, because someone who is accustomed to this almost can't do tshuva. Okay, the Chofetz Chaim so wants you to be able to do tshuva for the sin that he's essentially saying, Bob is going to have this terrible experience of you telling him, I said something bad about you, in order so that I, Cecilia, can get some kapara, can get some forgiveness for this. Okay, I just want to make sure that we understand this. I'm going to repeat it one more time. The scenario is, I, Cecilia, said something negative about Bob, but Bob didn't know. But I sinned, and I want to get forgiveness. So I go over to Bob, and I say, Bob, listen, I don't think this way about you anymore. But I used to think that you were a miser, that you were hideous, that you're the worst. And I told that to Nancy. I'm so sorry. I really shouldn't have said that. Okay? Right? And so what you're doing is you're essentially, right, creating the problem as you're trying to fix it. In the kind of divine parallel case, there's a whole conversation about if someone is being tried for blasphemy, how do you do it? Because you don't want them to say the blasphemous thing in court because they're going to be blaspheming again. Okay, so we had this problem with Lashon Hara, and the Chofetz Chaim says, you got to do what you got to do. You got to tell Bob to his face the terrible thing you said to him. There's an oral tradition about Rabbi Sol Salanter, who was one of the founding figures of the Musar movement, right, which is really concerned with doing the kind of moral and ethical thing. And so we're going to read a version of this exchange in this responsa. So we're at Unam Hadavar Mekubal. Indeed, there is a tradition about. Indeed, there is a tradition about the book Chafetz Chaim and the Laws of Lashon Hara. That is the passage that we just read. It is said that the author brought it to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter and asked if he could leave the copy with him. Okay, when I have just written a book and I ask you if I could leave a copy with you, what I'm hoping for is that you're going to read the book, you're going to approve of the book, and you're going to write me an approbation, right? You're going to say, I read this book, Chofetz Chaim, it was awesome. Okay, that's what the Chofetz Chaim wants when he drops his book off at Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's house. And he assumes that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter is going to love it. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter is the guy that loves ethics and morals. I, the Chofetz Chaim, wrote the book, the Chofetz Chaim, about how you shouldn't speak evil about people. Chofetz Chaim thinks it's a slam dunk, and then he's going to get the approbation from Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. After reviewing it, okay, and instead of giving his gushpanka, instead of giving him a seal of approval, Rabbi Yisrael said to him, look, you conclude in your book that one who speaks gossip about their friend has to appease them and ask forgiveness. But I don't understand how, just because one wants to repent for the sin, it can possibly be permitted for him to cause their friend pain in this way. Okay, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter says no, right? What you are trying to do when you give your friend this information about the slander that you spoke about them is trying to cleanse your own conscience at the cost of your friends, right? You are being willing to cause your friend pain in order that you should have a clear conscience. With this example, right, I think really brings to the fore, right, is that we actually do this all the time. That I am going to give you a kind of cheap and ill-timed apology right before Yom Kippur because I am more concerned about my forgiveness from God than I am concerned about your feelings. I know it's not the right time for you. I know it feels kind of icky when the apology comes, you know, at the wrong moment. But what am I going to do? Clock is ticking. I need to get my forgiveness from God. And so Rav Soloveitchik, when he's trying to define the terms, you know, there's a lot of rich language around forgiveness and kapara and atonement. And, you know, he's trying to kind of make some order with these various terms in the very beginning of his masterpiece on repentance. It's not, he didn't write the book. When Pinchas H. Pelley transcribed the notes. For those of you who are interested in the book, it's actually a tremendous book. And it's also very interesting that the original was written in Hebrew by Pinchas Pelley. And the English was written by Pinchas Pelley. Okay, he was a native English speaker and he translated his own work with the help of his wife. It's a very interesting and like very significant work on its own. And it's also a really amazing study in like translation and the limits of translation. That the person who wrote their own book, when they tried to translate it, you know, really ran into a lot of difficulties and is very transparent about that. It's very interesting. Okay, side note. Rav Soloveitchik says, kapara means forgiveness or withdrawal of a claim. This is a legal concept borrowed from the laws of property. Just as one may release his fellow man of a debt owed to him, so may God absolve one of the penalty to which he is liable due to sin. Kapara removes the need for punishment by means of repentance, and kapara, acquittal, I think it's, and through kapara, man puts a protective covering between himself and the punishment for his sin. All this concerns the liability incurred by the sinner. Okay, so when we talk about atonement, when we talk about forgiveness, right, we often like to think that it's a mutual thing, right? But what Rav Soloveitchik is actually saying quite clearly, really it's about me wanting to absolve myself of guilt. It's about me wanting to escape responsibility, me wanting to escape my punishment. When push comes to shove, you want to know what Yom Kippur is about? It's about me evading responsibility. There's a narrative about Yom Kippur where that is what is happening. I sinned. I really am responsible for the punishment, but I don't want the punishment. So I ask God for mercy and I say, God, let me level with you. I did it. You know I did it. I know I did it. But I don't want to be punished for it. Can you make this up? Right? What if I'm here next year? And God's like, you know what? I love you. No problem. But that, right, that whole interaction is really for my benefit so that I am not going to get this penalty. Right? And what Rav Soloveitchik is not saying, because this is not his conversation, but what I am saying through him is that is a really unhealthy way to look at my relationship and my interaction with other people, right? I need to be sure that I don't have that transactional attitude, that desire to evade responsibility, to just be clean from my friend. Right? What I need to have is a victim-centered approach, right? Where what they want, the kind of reconciliation that they are looking for, the kind of reconciliation that they are ready for is the one that I'm working towards and the one that I am building. And the last source that we are going to see is a commentary of Rabbeinu Batya on the story of Joseph and his brothers. If you remember way back in the beginning, we said that you're only allowed to ask for forgiveness three times. Once three times have passed, you're not allowed to ask for forgiveness anymore. And the paradigm for that was Joseph and his brothers. Okay, those little quotelets from the verses were verses from the Joseph and his brothers story. And he is looking at this scene of Yosef crying when he speaks to his brothers. As soon as the brothers merely mentioned the name of their father, Yosef already started weeping. This was due to the great love he had for his now departed father. This stirred his sense of compassion, especially seeing that his brothers asked for forgiveness. But the Torah does not spell out that Joseph actually forgave his brothers. Our sages point out that if a person has wronged his fellow man and regrets this wrong and determines not to act in the manner which had offended his fellow man, he is not forgiven by God until after he has made an effort to obtain forgiveness by the aggrieved party first. At any rate, the Torah is not on record anywhere that Joseph did forgive his brothers. Okay? And the reason why I wanted to end the class with this image is that I think it's extremely difficult, right, for us to come to terms with that there are certain relationships that are never going to be back the way that they were. And the story with Yosef and his brothers, I think, is a particularly fascinating example because we don't have enough time to look at the verses inside, but essentially what the brothers say is, Yosef, you need to forgive us because Dad said that you should. And Yosef starts crying and he's moved by this, but he doesn't forgive them. But at the same time, we know, right, that he provided for them. He never took revenge on them. And he gave them everything that they needed, but not the forgiveness he couldn't do. And I think that it provides for us a kind of model for, if we can't have forgive and forget, that doesn't mean, right, that the relationship is over. It doesn't mean that it's going to be bad blood. But what it does mean is that there's certain things that we can't take back. There's certain things that we can't fix. And what I'm wrestling with this Yom Kippur, and what I'm sort of, you know, thinking through, I think for those of you who also read my contribution to the High Holiday Reader, you know, already saw that I'm working on this theme, is to move to a place of trying to take responsibility for our actions around Yom Kippur, to use Yom Kippur as the time to start thinking about what would be the right way to approach my friend, as opposed to thinking of Yom Kippur as being the deadline for when everything needs to be resolved and everything needs to be tied up. Because the feeling of this pressure, we got to get it done by Yom Kippur or God's not going to forgive me, is going to exacerbate the problems, and being willing, right, to let things run their course and even being willing to say, it's my friend's right. They don't owe me an apology. Sorry, they don't owe me forgiveness. Saying that they don't owe me forgiveness can often be the first step towards getting to as close to forgiveness as possible, right? Really allowing the process to be led by and worked through by the person who is the aggrieved party, and being respectful of their process, and being there with them in that timeline.
Our producers for this episode are Sam Greenberg, Analia Burstein-Simpson, and Susan Pilevsky. Thank you to Nadav Remez for editing this episode. Additional editing by David Chabinsky. I'm your host, Ellie Confer. It's been a pleasure to learn with you.